So it's becoming almost a tradition that the Dharma Friends puts on a Halloween party of sorts and ritual. And it's almost a tradition that they then beforehand ask me to give a talk the Monday before their party, their event, talking about the Buddhist's idea of hungry ghosts and demons. And so that's what I'll do. I'll give a talk, kind of a Halloween talk, Halloweenish talk perhaps. And I find it very interesting that, you know, the meaning of the word Halloween, maybe not all of you know, not all of you maybe know, you know, or native to English. And the word hollow from Halloween means sacred. And the een part of Halloween means evening, I guess in English or Old English or Scottish or I don't know, Irish or Welsh or I don't know. And so it's the sacred evening. And it's always the evening before November 1st. We usually say it's the last evening of October. But the really important date is that it's the last evening before November 1st. And November 1st is All Saints Day. How many of you knew that? You all know this. And it's All Saints Day, and which is a very sacred day, right? All the saints, you know, Mother Teresa will be there. And you know, it's a very important day. And so what's interesting is the day before this sacred saintly day is it's become the custom to invite or respect or be frightened by the local demons and ghosts and witches and wizards and kids. And there is some wisdom, I think, to having just before kind of opening to the more sacred, pure part of a day of a calendar, to that part which is more demonic. You know, angels in the old times were frightening beings. Nowadays, they've been thoroughly domesticated, and they become, you know, more than to become a commercial product. All these wonderful, sweet, angelic things, and sweet angels. And but there was a time when at least in the Judeo-Christian tradition, where angels could be quite frightening, and people wrestled with angels. Was it Abraham who wrestled with angels? Who was it? Jacob. Anyway, people wrestled with, you know, and. So before kind of this sacred time, I like the idea that there's a time to open up to or recognize that part of ourselves, which is the part of society or life, which is more the opposite of that, demonic. And I feel more confidence in that movement, that actually the movement to purity or sacred or saintly or whatever would go through a recognition of paying respects, of opening to that which is difficult and the hindrances, the obstacles, the afflictive emotions, that which we're most frightened of. And then opening up to what most frightens us is a wonderful gate to a real realistic kind of inner peace or peace or purity. And I've known plenty of people who've been attached to purity, attached to peace, inner peace, attached to the saintly, who've done so at the expense of ignoring that part of themselves or that part of society which is frightening or terrifying. And it seemed very lopsided and very unhealthy, that kind of sharp division between the two. It's been said sometimes that Buddhism doesn't hold up a very sharp duality between the sacred and the profane, or the sacred and the saintly, the pure and the impure, the saintly and the demonic. In a sense, because the enlightenment that Buddhism ultimately points towards belongs to a dimension of life which is considered to be separate from that which is saintly and demonic, or pure and impure, or maybe even beyond or separate from that which is sacred and profane. Those kind of dualities don't quite make sense as you get into the practice deeply. There's a tradition, there's a story from the Zen tradition, maybe a kind of a legendary story, of a very pure Buddhist monk in China. And he was known for his purity, and part of his saintly quality was that the animals would come and, to him and eat out of his hands, and the birds would land on his shoulder, and it was very, very beautiful. And then he met a Zen teacher and practiced with him, and under the Zen teacher's tutelage, he became enlightened. And after he became enlightened, the animals stopped coming to him. So exactly what that story means, I'm not sure. But I think it's a very interesting story that perhaps you can take from the story this idea he was attached to his purity. And somehow with his enlightenment, that that attachment, he was freed from it. And somehow the animals related to him differently. The Buddhist cosmology posits six different realms of existence. And kind of maybe like the way that Christian cosmology of a certain type would posit four realms of existence. Maybe there are more. But, you know, there's hell. At least the ones that Dante went to, right? There's four. You know, there's the human realm, and then there's hell, and then there's the realm of purgatory, and then there's the realm of heaven. So there's like, so the Buddhists have six realms. And there's a human realm, and there's a hell realm that Buddhists posit. Buddhism doesn't have any purgatory, in a sense, or unless everything's considered part of purgatory, because the idea ending in Christianity is that hell is eternal. Once you go to hell, unless you're Dante, that's it. And once you get to heaven, I think it's pretty much a done deal. You're there. And I think unless you're Lucifer or something, it's pretty much, you know, a good, you have a good time. But luckily, there's this place in between that's temporary, and you work through your sins and whatever, and eventually you get reborn in heaven. But so hell and heaven are kind of eternal. Buddhism doesn't posit anything eternal in that way, any of these dimensions. But they're all dimensions that that beings are cycling through all the time. And you might get reborn for a period of time in hell, and it might seem like eternity, but it's always going to be temporary. And or you might get reborn in heavenly realms, and it might seem like eternity, but it's also temporary. Temporary can mean something like 84 million years. So it can be a very long time. So there are six realms. So there's the human realm. There is the hell realms, and there are hot hells and cold hells, and there's all kinds of horrible descriptions. And Buddhist monks and teachers down through the ages haven't been, I don't know where to say, above, or kind of giving fire and brimstone kind of sermons that would really frighten people, to keep people kind of ethically pure. You know, if you do this, if you sleep with your neighbor's wife, you will go to that, you know, hell, or, you know, or 84 million years where all the adulterers, and they'll describe in graphic detail what that's like, and people would listen, and they would be good, or try to be, or be guilty, or afraid. I've known people who've been really afraid of Buddhist hells. They've gotten these graphic depictions and been really frightened by the possibility. So Buddhists have these great descriptions, and you can read about them. Or it's very rare that I think you find a Vipassana teacher in America, lay out descriptions of these hells. And those of you who come from religious backgrounds where you thought you're freeing yourself from that kind of thing, or maybe a little bit, what happened? Did I turn the wrong corner? I thought I came to Buddhism and it was to be free of all that. And here Gil's talking about cold hells and hot hells. Well, stay with me. Don't run away yet. And then there's also what's called the animal realm. So whereas maybe we think of the animal realm to be part of our realm, the Buddhists kind of consider that a separate realm from the human realm, because it's a different place you can get reborn. You can get reborn as an earthworm or as a dog or a deer, or different ways. And so that's one of the realms of rebirth, is to be animal. One of the characteristics of the animal realm, according to Buddhists, is fear. And confusion. There's a lot of fear and a lot of confusion if you get reborn as an animal. If you get reborn in hell, you just have a lot of suffering. Then there's a realm called the hungry ghosts. And the hungry ghost realms are these beings that have these humongously big bellies. They look like they're ready to pop, really big. Like, you know, they go out and out. And they have these really, really, really narrow throats. I mean, they're so narrow you can hardly get, you know, a drop of water down them. So these beings are, because of these big bellies, they're always hungry. And they can never get enough food into their belly to be satisfied. So they're always roaming around, hungry for more, wanting. And so there's craving. They're kind of tormented by their craving. That's the realm of hungry ghosts. And then there's the realm of the asuras. And these are sometimes translated as the titans. And these are kind of like gods, except their big thing is, what they suffer when there is jealousy. And so if people have a lot of jealousy, they get reborn as these kind of, but have lived a certain life of purity and goodness and all that, but are still kind of tormented by their jealousy. They get reborn as these titans. And the titans are always going to war with the gods. They're jealous of the gods because the gods have it really good. And that's the sixth realm. That's the next realm. The fifth realm is that of the gods. And the god realm is just mostly just a good scene, except when the titans come and fight. And there's like levels of hell, of heavens, just like there's levels of hells. And I don't really know so well all the levels of heavens, but you know, there's at least 33. I think there's 33 levels of hell in the form realms of heaven. 33 realms of heaven in the form realms of heaven. And then there's a formless realms of heaven where the beings don't have any form, and they just like, you know, beings of light or, you know, formless beings that, and it's really blissful up there. Anyways, there's all these realms, and there's a lot of bliss, a lot of joy. And the lower ones are all about sensual joy, and the higher ones are more spiritual joy. So hell, animal, hungry ghost, titans, and heavens. And the sixth realm is the human realm. And that is the realm that we've all been born into, according to Buddhist ideas, classic Buddhist ideas. And it said the best place to get reborn is actually in the human realm. Because the human realm, you have just the right combination, just the right balance of suffering and happiness. And you see, if you get reborn in the hell realms, you're suffering so much that you just can't do anything but complain or just suffer or just feel tormented. And you don't get enough presence of mind to be interested in spiritual practice. If you get reborn in the heavenly realms, you have so much joy and happiness and pleasure that you're not going to be interested in spiritual practice either, because why bother? I've been told by my friends who are meditation teachers in Hawaii that they'll put on a one-day retreat there, and it's very hard for people, no one really comes. Because if people are feeling a little bit kind of down about their life in Hawaii, they go to the beach. Hawaii being kind of a heavenly realm. So that kind of principle then, you know, with the heavenly realms. But here in the human realm, it said to be the only realm really where people can practice, where they have enough choice and enough presence of mind to see where they're at and what's going on, that they can start engaging their life to change the current of life, the direction their life is going, and to move their life into, move towards freedom, or develop themselves spiritually. So it's considered very opportune to be born as a human being. And then Buddhist teachers love to give these talks to really drive home how lucky you are to be as a human being. You know how rare it is to be born as a human being? Some of you know this already. You know how rare? This is what they say. If there was a blind turtle out in the ocean, a blind turtle, and that blind turtle only surfaced up out of the surface, you know, his head surfaced out of the ocean surface once every 100 years, and there was a log out there in that ocean, that in the middle of that log there was a hole, the chances of that blind turtle surfacing its head up through the hole in that log is about the chances that a being has to be born as a human being. So this is a great opportunity. Don't blow it. It might be a long time before you get this chance again. So you get kind of the gist of certain kind of classic Buddhist teaching then, you know, hell and how horrible it is, and even heaven is not that great, because, you know, eventually you're going to die from heaven and come back someplace that's lower, it's worse. And so, you know, just, you want to get off. You want to get out of the cycles. That's a classic view. You don't want to be reborn in any of these six realms of existence. Now, there's a strong current of teaching in Buddhism, and this is especially true in the modern world, that takes these six realms to be symbolic or metaphoric for states of mind that we cycle through. And any given day, any given hour, we cycle through these six realms. There are times when we fall into great states of suffering, and life is really hard, and it's, you know, we kind of also can't hardly see how to go forward. And just, you know, sometimes suffering, human suffering, is really seemingly unbearable. It's awful what happens to human beings, to all of us at times. And then we cycle through states perhaps of being confused and frightened, like animals are supposed to be. Or then we cycle through stages of being like hungry ghosts, and just craving machines. We just can't get enough. We get something, we want more and more and more. And then we have periods of being jealous. And then there are times we just blissed out. We just feel great joy and happiness. Things are really great. When I was in practicing meditation in Burma, I hadn't practiced Vipassana except in Asia when I was first practiced it. And I met these practitioners in Asia, in Nepal, in Burma, who had practiced in America at IMS. And they kept saying, oh, IMS is like living in the heavenly realms compared to practicing on retreat here in Asia. And Spirit Rock, if you've ever been there, it's like being in a heavenly realm. It just, you know, you might be suffering, but the place is, you know, divine. It's a really amazing place. And or then you might be a human. You know, in this kind of metaphor, the mythologized version of these six realms, you're not always a human being. You feel like that way sometimes? You know, that sometimes your ability to be attentive and use your exercise your power of choice and mindfulness, bring compassion up, to engage in practice, you know, sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. And what we're trying to do is, when it's there, to utilize that opportunity more and more, so it becomes a habit, becomes a strength, something we fall back to more often. So rather than something we only notice once a week or once a month, or it really becomes more and more that we find ourselves in the human realm of life, and that we really respect and honor how important it is to wake up. To wake up, in a sense, is to wake up to be a human being and not to be lost in these other five realms. And, you know, sometimes certain personalities and people seem to, you know, be more in one realm than the other. You probably know people who are kind of the hungry ghost type, and they're just always wanting more from you, and you just can't give them enough, and just more attention, more this, more everything. And insatiable need, insatiable desire. You know, or people who are mostly a fear type, just seems to be, have a lot of fear. And a lot of anxiety and restlessness around that, or confusion. So you know, in a sense, we all have all realms within us. We all visit them all the time, in certain ways, certain degrees. And it's important to be able to recognize all the aspects of ourselves, not just certain aspects of ourselves. If we only think that, you know, what's important is to be divine, to have divine experiences, to only be in heavenly kind of realms, then it's, from the Buddhist point of view, you're actually kind of truncating or separating yourself from an important part of who you are. If you only kind of go in the demonic sides or the suffering side, then you're also cutting yourself off from part of who you are. And what would be healthy is to get a sense of the wholeness of who you are, all aspects, and not to leave some things in the shadow. You know, I'm not going to pay attention to that, or I can't admit that, no way. But rather admit all of it as it arises, see all of it, be very honest about all aspects of who we are. And that's partly, I think, what Halloween can mean for some people, is you kind of take take some part that's been disowned, or part you don't pay attention to much, and really kind of indulge in it, really let it have its day in the sun. In some traditional cultures all over the world, there was a notion of carnival. And we, you know, sometimes we still do carnival a little bit here in America, but carnival was sometimes understood to be kind of a holiday where all the social norms, rules of society were turned upside down. And you know, it certainly was a great way of kind of taking the pressure that was building up in society and kind of exhausting it, kind of like expending it. But it was also, you know, turning everything upside down and letting everybody see, you know, different aspects of themselves. Letting the people who are oppressed be, you know, the rulers for the day, perhaps, or the people who are rulers to be the servants for the day, or all kinds of ways in which things are turned upside down. And perhaps Halloween, a little bit that kind of way of turning things upside down so we can see things freshly in a new way. But in some way, to spend time with that which we're most afraid of. What are you most afraid of in your life? Or what are you most afraid of inside of yourself? What are you most afraid to look at, to recognize? I was, for a long time, most afraid to recognize my anger. I should probably should have dressed up as some, you know, angry, jealous titan. Some people are afraid of that which is beautiful, or that which is tender, or that which is vulnerable inside of them. Some people are afraid of their fear. And, you know, are tremendously resistance to being, you know, going close to where they're afraid. Some people are afraid of their confusion, admitting they're confused, having a not knowing mind. And, you know, they can't show that. They have to always kind of be on top of things. What are you most afraid of? Are you willing to face your fears, sit with your fears, be with your fears? Here's a story from the Thai forest tradition. In this tradition, monks would often go sit in the forest and meditate. And this is a story of a monk who accidentally went to stay in a forest located near a charnel ground. Back not so distant past in Thailand, they would they wouldn't bury bodies. They would bring bodies out to this open field, kind of some distance from the village, and they'd usually burn the body. And then they would just leave the body burning there while everybody went back to their village, and it would just smolder there until it burned out. And then I don't know what they did with the body next. But so this monk had arrived at a certain village late one afternoon, and being unfamiliar with the area, asked the villagers where he could find a wooded area suitable for meditation. They pointed to a tract of forest, claiming it was suitable, but neglected to tell him that it was situated right on the edge of a charnel ground. They then guided him to the forest, where he passed the first night peacefully. On the following day, he saw the villagers pass by carrying a corpse, which they soon cremated only a short distance from where he was staying. As he looked on, he could clearly see the burning corpse. He started to grow apprehensive the moment he saw the coffin being carried past, but he assumed that they were on their way to cremate the body somewhere else. Still, the mere sight of the coffin caused him considerable consternation as he thought ahead to the coming night. He was worried that the image of the coffin would haunt him after dark, making it impossible for him to sleep. As it turned out, he had camped on the edge of the charnel ground, so he was obliged to watch the corpse as the corpse was burned right in front of him. This sight upset him even more, causing him severe discomfort as he contemplated the prospect of having to spend the night there. Feeling very uneasy from the first sight of the corpse passing by, the feeling gradually intensified until he was so terrified that by nightfall he could hardly breathe. Once all the villagers had gone home, leaving him alone, his torment began in earnest. He could not keep his mind focused on meditation because whenever he closed his eyes to meditate, he saw a long line of ghosts moving toward him. Before long ghosts hovered around him in groups, an image which frightened him so much that all presence of mind deserted him, throwing him into a panic. His fear began in mid-afternoon at the first sight of the corpse. By the time darkness fell all around, his fear had become so intense he was just barely able to cope. Since ordaining as a monk, he had never experienced anything like this struggle with visions of ghosts. At least he was mindful enough to begin reflecting. The fear, the ghosts, all of it may simply be a delusion. It is more likely that these haunting images of ghosts are creations of my own mind. As a monk, he was expected to be steadfast and fearless when facing death, ghosts, or any other danger. So he reminded himself, people everywhere praise the fearless courage of monks, yet here I am shamelessly afraid of ghosts. I am acting like a total failure, as though I have ordained just to live in fear of ghosts and goblins without any rhyme or reason. I am a disgrace to my fellow monks. I am unworthy of admiration of people who believe we are noble warriors fearing nothing. How could I let this happen? Having reminded himself of this, and roundly criticizing himself for failing to live up to these high standards, he resolved that he would force himself to face the fear directly from then on. The corpse that smoldered before him on the funeral pyre being the cause of his fear, he decided to go there immediately. Putting on his robe, he started walking straight for the funeral pyre, which he saw clearly glowing in the darkness. But after a few steps, his legs tensed up, and he could hardly move. His heart pounded. His body began to perspire profusely, as though exposed to midday sun. Seeing that this was not going too well, he quickly adjusted his tack. Starting with small, deliberate steps, he placed one foot just in front of the other, not allowing his forward motion to stop. By that time, he was relying on sheer strength of will to push his body forward. Frightened to death and shaking uncontrollably, he nevertheless kept his resolve to walk on, as though his life depended on it. Struggling the entire way, he eventually reached the burning corpse. But instead of feeling relieved that he had achieved his objective, he felt so faint he could barely stand. About to go crazy with fear, he forced himself to look at the partially burned corpse. Then, seeing the skull burned white from the long exposure to the fire, he got such a fright that he nearly fainted straight away. Bravely suppressing his fear, he sat down to meditate just a short distance from the burning pyre. He focused on the corpse, using it as an object of his meditation, while forcing his terrified heart to mentally recite continuously, I am going to die, just like this corpse. There's no need to be afraid. I'm going to die someday too. There's no point in being afraid. Sitting there grappling with his fear of ghosts and forcing his heart to repeat this meditation on death, he heard a strange sound just behind him. Should I stop here? The sound of approaching footsteps. The footsteps stopped, then started again, slow and cautious, as if someone were sneaking up to pounce on him from behind, or so he imagined at the time. His fear now reached its peak. He was poised to jump up and run away, crying, "Ghosts, help!" But he managed to control this impulse and waited, listening nervously as the footsteps slowly drew nearer, then stopped a few yards away. Poised to run, he heard a strange sound, like someone chewing, loud and crunchy. This sent his imagination racing. What's it chewing on around here? Next it'll be chewing on my head. This cruel, heartless ghost is sure to mean the end of me. Unable to stand the suspense any longer, he decided to open his eyes. Should the situation look drastic, he was prepared to run for his life. A far better option than just letting some terrible ghost devour him. Escaping now, he reasoned, will give him the chance to resume my practice later with renewed diligence, whereas I am gaining nothing by sacrificing my life to this ghost. With that, He opened his eyes and turned to look in the direction of the chewing, crunching sounds, all set to make a dash for his life. Peering through the darkness to catch a glimpse of the terrible ghost he had imagined, he saw instead a village dog, casually chewing the scraps of food left by the villagers as offerings to the spirits as part of the local custom. It had come scrounging for something to fill its stomach, as hungry animals are wont to do, and it wasn't the least bit interested in him sitting there. Suddenly realizing that it was only a dog, the monk laughed at his own folly, turning his attention to the dog, which showed no interest in him whatsoever. He thought, "So, you're the almighty specter that nearly drove me crazy. You taught me the lesson of my life." With self-admonishing him fresh in his mind, the monk made a solemn vow. "I will not leave this place until I have overcome my fear of ghosts. If I have to die trying, then so be it. If I can't defeat this fear, then I won't deserve to continue living in such disgrace. Others might follow my bad example, becoming useless people themselves, thus further increasing the burden on the sasana, on the teachings. So he vowed to himself that from that moment on, he'd remain in that cemetery day and night as a way of dealing sternly with his fear. And it goes on, and then it ends by saying, "Eventually he transformed himself into a monk of incredible courage in all circumstances. This whole experience had a profound and lasting impact on his spiritual development. His fear of ghosts gave rise to an outstanding lesson in the teaching, thus converting him into a truly authentic monk." So what are you afraid of? So there is a tradition in Buddhism that the things that frighten us the most are just projections of our own mind. And I think maybe they can be sometimes. Even sometimes we're afraid of other people. It's sometimes a projection of our own mind. There's a story, a friend of mine had a dream many years ago. And maybe, I'm sorry if I told this story recently or not, but in the dream he was holding a poisonous snake by the neck. And if you hold a poisonous snake by the neck, it's safe. It can't bite you. But he wanted to let go of the snake. But he couldn't let go of it because then it could turn around and bite him. So he was holding it. What to do? And finally, in the dream, he let go of the snake. And when he let go of the snake vanished. What are you afraid of? Just the, you know, the theme. What are you afraid of? What are you holding on to? In the last demon story, actually, Milarepa was this famous Tibetan ascetic who spent years and years living in a cave. He was out from his cave one day and he came back. And there were these five ferocious, horrible demons with big teeth and dripping blood down, you know, his face and just with red, fiery eyes, you know, there to get him. And he gulped and he looked at them and he said, I know why they're here. I've been here for many years. They're the demons of this cave. But I've never made offerings to them, never paid my respects to them. So he made some offerings and he paid his respects and he honored them. And two of them receded away, but three of them kept coming at him. So he said, "Oh, the thing to do is to frighten them." So he made his huge, wrathful fury, gestures of fury, and gnashed his teeth, and rawr. And sure enough, two of them got frightened, and they receded into the cave. And that left one left, the biggest one, the most ferocious one, coming after him, coming after you, right? And what are you going to do now? All your strategies have worked. The respectful strategies, the kind one, the friendly ones worked. The ferocious ones worked for those first four, but the biggest one, those don't work. So then he thought, he considered, oh, these demons. These demons are just a product of my own mind. And then he laid himself down in the mouth of the biggest one. And it's vanished. So, may you have a wonderful Halloween. Do you have any comments or questions you'd like to make? We have about 5 minutes. It seems complete enough. You're all properly frightened. Stunned. Yes. Probably it was there from day one, in that it was part of the Indian cosmology at the time of the Buddha. And so it was just there already. He was raised in that cosmology. It wasn't Buddhist cosmology, it was just the Indian cosmology of his time. And there were a lot of elements that we now consider to be Buddhist that were not the Buddhist originally, just part of the local scene. And the six realms, I think, were just part of that early scene. And then how much was the Buddha interested in it? Did the Buddha believe in it? Did he see it as being a symbolic of states of mind, or did he see it as being real realities? It's really hard to know. There certainly is a lot of indications in the early literature that some of these things, like Mara, the Buddhist devil, was understood in symbolic ways, as aspects of one's own mind rather than an external being. And it's hard to know. In the modern world, there's much stronger tendency to see these as representing, you know, symbolic representation of mental states rather than external realities. This is the biography of the Venerable Acharya Mun. Ajahn Mun is, in a sense, the spiritual grandfather to Ajahn Amaro. The Thai forest tradition that Thanissara Bhikkhu comes from, and Ajahn Sumedho, and Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Amaro, and all those people, they all trace their origins to this man here, who lived... I think he died in about, he was a relatively old man, I think about 1948. And so he kind of spanned the 19th and 20th centuries. And he kind of rediscovered, I don't know if rediscovered, but he kind of, his own practice and his own being who he was and his own realization gave birth to the what's now called the Thai forest tradition. And there's a lot of stories like this in this book. So I hope all of you find an occasion to sit down and meditate in the midst of what frightens you the most. Thank you.